With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Good morning, and you're with Marie here on Counterculture with Reality Check Radio. Joining me now is one of the most popular guests I had of 2023, and I'm so delighted to have him back in 2024. Almost actually a year since we spoke was Josh Slocum from the Disaffected podcast. Good morning, Josh. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. It's good to talk to you again, Marie.
Oh, it is so good to talk to you. And if you haven't checked out Josh's podcast, Disaffected, it is on Rumble. And I do note, we are now doing live broadcasts, Josh.
We did it live for the first time last week. I do not know if we will do it again. I mean, we'll probably go to live as a regular thing. Don't know whether that's going to be this week, but technical snafus and traveling producers conspired in such a way that it was actually technically better for us to just go live and live with the mistakes than it would have been to try to get it edited in the can before the appointed hour. So that's what we did.
And, you know, the funny old thing, having done a lot of live radio in the past, and you just have to fly by the seat of your pants. And it's like, okay, that's happened. We just keep going. You're like a snowplow. Yep. You just keep plowing on through. Yeah,
it's mistakes are going to happen. Who cares? There's always another show.
Yeah, exactly. Your show is quite different because you look at the world and culture and the communities and such that you live in through the lens of Cluster B personality disorder. So as a quick recap for listeners that haven't caught that interview from last year, what are the four main Cluster B personality types?
Right. They are called borderline personality disorder, histrionic personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, and antisocial personality disorder, which people may know as sociopathy or psychopathy. Mm. And basically, personality disorders are a kind of mental problem that's very deep and ingrained in people. It's, another word for these are character disorders. It is personal. I see this as moral, not medical. It's not the kind of mental illness that there is a medication for. We're talking about people, the commonality that binds these allegedly four discrete disorders, and I think most people who fall into Cluster B don't fit neatly into just one of four categories. There's a lot of overlap. But narcissism, extreme narcissism, self-absorption, and resulting emotionally abusive behaviors to other people are what bind them together.
Mm. And of course, with the culture wars today, we see that demonstrated on a daily basis if you have to interact with any of these people. And speaking of interactions, have you caught up? Because, I mean, the whole trans community is really riding roughshod across a lot of Western canons now that the sort of tsunami of COVID has dissipated and the tide has gone out. The sort of trans radical faction, I think, have moved in to pick up that level of anxiety and space and power vacuum that has been left by for many in the social milieu since COVID dissipated. The CAS report in the UK, well, firstly, the WPATH files that were broken there in the US and via Michael Schellenberger and Mayor Thomas and his team, and then latterly the CAS report in the UK followed up the following month. That must be sending shockwaves through the trans community. What are you observing on your side of the pond that's been going on across there?
Less than you might think. My perception right now is that the trans activists it's not just trans activists. It is the entire allegedly respectable medico-legal structure in this country. The entire structure is completely captured by this lunacy. And I think that right now they think that this is not going to have any real effect in the United States. There has been some kick up about it. you'll see it online. You'll see the usual suspects, the named people who are the trans activists that you expect to see, complaining about this, saying it's going to kill people. It's based on faulty science. It's all reversal and projection. Mm. This is part of narcissism. You reverse the truth. You project onto other people the very things that you are actually guilty of. And I don't know if they're right, Murray. It's been frustrating because the U.S. is very good at being an outlier when it wants to, and I think it's still trying to be an outlier on the trans issue, because of course, as we know, after the release of the WPATH files, which coincided with, and I don't know how much is causative, how much is correlative, how much is coincidental timing, coincided with. It seems to me the majority of European countries saying, we're not going to give children, we're not going to give them puberty blockers anymore. We're not going to give them cross-sex hormones, and we're certainly not going to allow minors to have surgery. Whereas the U.S. is sitting here doing its U.S. thing.
Yeah. Do you think that they've, in the U.S., they've actually entrenched back into the state model, so they've deferred that from a federal decision and said to the states, you guys sort it out, so then that way they can clean their hands of this. Biden and the Democratic administration can say, no, we're still there for trans rights. I mean, like the ultimate virtue signal, instead of the Easter egg hunt on the White House lawn, you have, what was it, Trans Day of Visibility? Yeah. I mean, really?
And you think to yourself, can we have one bloody day where they're invisible, please? How about a trans day of silence? Just blessed silence. I mean, there are literally dozens of designated special days on their special calendars for trans people, for intersex people, for LGBTQIA, for the non-binary, and also lesbian identify, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, I think that's what's happening. So the United States, of course, we are a republic. We're a federated republic. Well, I mean, you're a federated system. Australia is a federated system. They have states. But I don't think we in the United States we're not going to have an equivalent to England's NHS saying, okay, this is stopped now, because we don't have that national level structure. And I highly doubt, well, I know for certain that with the makeup of our government, our legislature right now, I know for certain this won't happen. But even if that changes, I highly doubt that we're going to see a federal ban on this form of extreme child abuse, which makes me sick. It is probably going to have to go state by state by state by state and lawsuit by lawsuit, because those are the two things that move American politics.
Something like along the lines of 22, I think, have banned them so far. So it's not quite half.
Not quite half, but we're getting there. But frustratingly, of course, but predictably, it is broken down on partisan lines. The states that have banned this child mutilation correctly, as they should, are seen as Republican / conservative / red states. Those are the words that we use to describe the right wing. And of course, all the so-called blue states, the leftist progressive states, see this. Well, I mean, they are the ones who opened the salvo in this war to begin with, because it was these blue progressive states, such as mine, Vermont, Minnesota, California, and I think a few others, have passed what are called trans sanctuary state laws. And these are laws that say, if you bring a child or your child into our state for the purpose of getting them, quote, gender affirming care, then we, the sanctuary state, will they're breaking our federal constitution, Marie. There's a clause in our federal constitution called the Full Faith and Credit Clause. What that means, our federated system depends on that. That is a mandate that all states must treat the legal actions of the legislatures and courts in other states as on a par with theirs. These trans sanctuary state laws are deliberately breaking that constitutional mandate by saying, I'll use California as an example. Mom who wants to bring the kid into California to trans the kid and dad in another, she takes him out of the state of Texas because Texas bans this, takes him to California for this express purpose of transing that kid. California says, even if a court in Texas has an arrest warrant out for this abducting parent, we will not cooperate. We will not extradite. We will not respond to court orders. We will not respond to discovery or production demands. It's quite extraordinary.
That's
and they are getting
insane.
Away with it.
That is insane. You know, I just wrote this down, as you said, with moms, because one of the things the case report really didn't go into, and I mean, to be fair, it was outside its scope of its scope to begin with. But I know it's something that Helen Joyce talks about, and it's certainly something that I've witnessed here, which is the element of social contagion. And Abigail Schreier talks about that a lot in her book, Irreversible Damage.
Yes.
And she discusses how this, in a way, with young women, is like bulimia and cutting of the 90s and the early 2000s.
Yes.
It is a social contagion that is running through girls, as these tend to do, young teenage girls. One of the things that I've seen with this trans issue is the involvement of parents of it. So you have a number of parents that get blindsided who have their daughter come home and they say, look, Joanna no longer wants to be Joanna. She wants to be Jo. And they want these pronouns to be observed and all of these things. Mm-hmm. And they're like, whoa. But I've observed with some of the social fabrics and involvements that I have that actually it's the parents that seem to be driving this with their kids. So you've got, and particularly parents who are deeply embedded within woke culture and the culture wars, all of a sudden there is an epidemic of these super woke parents, whether they be from celebrities to moms in the suburbs, who all of a sudden is, oh, I've got a trans-identified child. So I can't quite decide whether it's the narcissistic mother or the social contagion to child, but it seems to be...
It's all of these things. It's all of these things in various proportions. I'm going to... I'm going to specify a little bit. It's not parents, it's mothers. For every 20 mothers transing their child, you'll find maybe one father who's doing it. So yes, fathers do it, but no, it's not parents, it's mothers. Why is that? Munchausen syndrome by proxy, which, if your viewers are not familiar with, is the mental illness where a caregiver, almost always a mother, and when I say almost always, I mean about 98% of documented cases, almost always a mother, induces or pretends to induce physical or psychological illness in a child for the purpose of getting attention and praise for being a selfless martyr of a mother who will do anything for her poor sick child. We all recognize that phenomenon. Those of us who are old enough remember when it was a topic of movie of the week in the 1990s. I conceive of Munchausen's by proxy. It is not a standalone mental illness. It is a symptomatic expression of a cluster B personality disorder, usually borderline / narcissistic histrionic. So this is our version. This is our era's version of the 1990s mother who put Lysol in her child's soup, or Dee Dee Blanchard was a famous case in the United States. She had a daughter named Gypsy Rose, whom she claimed had cancer and needed a feeding tube. She forced her daughter to stay in a wheelchair, even though Gypsy Rose had nothing somatically wrong with her. She had no illness at all. And this woman, her mother, Dee Dee Blanchard, kept her there her entire life through her teen years, raised a lot of money, had all sorts of benefits done for her behalf, and did this all for attention. We can all see that that is pathological behavior, but that is exactly it's not like this. It is this. It's not eerily similar. It is the same. this is what these mothers are doing. And it's of a piece with, it's the same personality type that is a stage mother, who would put her daughter into beauty pageants from a young age. It's the same personality type that brings her son to Hollywood to be a famous child actor. It's the same thing.
It's terrifying, isn't it? So terrifying.
What's terrifying to me is that a person like me has to say it this explicitly and didactically, because I know everyone sees it. I know they do. They simply pretend that they don't. That's the other thing that frustrates me, Marie, about the cast report. And this is not a criticism of the cast report, nor is it a criticism of their team. We don't need a damned report to tell us that it is abusive to stop a child's puberty, to collude in a mental delusion within a child, and that delusion is, I am the opposite sex from the one that I am. It is evil to collude in that because it calcifies and concretizes mental illness. It is evil and abusive to mutilate the genitals or the breasts of a minor child. This is why we have laws against what's called female genital mutilation. And yet the very same feminists who lobbied for these laws against female genital mutilation, many of them, not all, some see it, but many. Oh no, this is loving care. Mm. It's loving care when we mutilate the genitals for trans. So it frustrates me. I understand that it's necessary. The world is not going to be arranged the way I would like to see it arranged, but it is scandalous and appalling and an indictment of all of us adults that we needed the CAS report to finally stop this shit.
Yeah, I think the one thing the CAS report has done, and particularly for us in this hemisphere in New Zealand, being a Commonwealth nation, we do often look to and sometimes defer to decisions or things happening in, you know, in the motherland, even though we're still, yes, we're quite independent and quite separate. And one of the things I've noticed, and I noticed this with our change of government at the end of the year, it's almost like there is this silent, tacit permission that gets granted,
yes,
to all of those that observe and see these things, but have been, yes, too terrified to speak out. So then
you're
they,
right.
They,
you are, you're right. And it's necessary. It's personally very frustrating to me. People have different levels of courage, naturally. And that's simply the way humans are. But I'm sorry. I'm not going to be understanding about this. Mm. It should not take an extraordinary level of courage to say, holy God, it's appalling that you're talking about taking a boy's testicles off. Oh my God, are you actually proposing using chemical castration drugs that we use on rapists, on children, to stop their natural puberty? You're really suggesting that? Nope, no extraordinary courage is necessary to object to that. We have lowered our standards of accountability for us as adults to the floor.
Well, see, I think that this is what you've gotten and done is just actually described the complicitness now of the media in all of this, because it's the media that have used language along with those who are in pro-gender treatment, and yep, they have manipulated the descriptions, oh, yeah, of,
absolutely,
all of these things. So then the layperson look at it and they go, well, hold on. No, that's, of course, there's, yes, we, you know, we want to be good. We want to affirm. We want to be nice, because no one wants to be told that they're nasty.
Yep.
And that's where that manipulation, I think, has been very, very profound. In this country,
yes,
there's been, it's gone beyond that. We have an activist here who was at the forefront of conversion therapy legislation. And the great irony is, as you said before, it's that reverse projection, you know, and we have a set of legislation that is essentially, no, this legislation is to prevent conversion therapy of gays and lesbians, when in fact it's to codify and protect the conversion therapy of our children into a trans cult.
Yes, yes, it is. It's legislating abuse. It is doing the exact thing. And let me, you know, I've got something to say about conversion therapy that is, I don't think is mentioned often enough. As a gay man myself, coming up on 50, I was a young man and a teenager during the era in which everybody said conversion therapy was going on. Guess what? It happened a couple of times to a few people in some very unusual circumstances. What do we mean specifically? Let's stop relying on cover labels and talk about what we actually mean. What people think they mean when they talk about conversion therapy are religious Christian fundamentalist Bible-based programs where men are exposed to where they're given nausea-inducing drugs if they have an erotic response to images of men, where they are shamed or physically punished every time they express something that looks gay. So what we're talking about, what is purportedly being talked about, are actually abusive practices, right? I mean, we can all agree that that's, you know, not great stuff to do. But we don't need these bloody conversion therapy bans because that happened so rarely to begin with. I mean, it really did. I mean, what are, if people out there who are listening to this right now believe that in the 1980s that an appreciable number of gay men were sent to this so-called conversion therapy, they believe a complete lie. I haven't met a single person in my entire life who was ever subjected to that. It was a rarity. Sure, make a law saying it can't happen, but this is very similar, Marie, to the dishonest beatification of a young man named Matthew Shepard, who was murdered more than 20 years ago in Laramie, Wyoming, and left tied to a fence in the middle of a field. And the narrative became he was gay bashed, he was murdered because he was gay, and then his mother went on a speaking tour, which she still is making her bread and butter from, and started the, you know, a foundation, you know, and homophobia and all this. It's all crap. He was not killed because he was gay. Matthew Shepard, sadly, I'm not criticizing poor dead Matthew Shepard, but poor dead Matthew Shepard was a drug addict who was sleeping with the men who killed him. That's the reality. This was not a homophobic hate crime. It was a drug deal gone bad because it was mixed up with sex and romance. The entire basis of this. So it's the same thing with conversion therapy. And now they come out and good-hearted people, people who think of themselves as compassionate, are going to say, of course, we don't want gay people to be abused that way. And they don't realize that they're being manipulated and their support is being, they're being induced to support something they don't understand that will not do what they hope it does and will actually do a bad thing that they don't know it will do.
It's that whole, and in terms of a bad thing, it's that whole thing tied up in that affirmation model that I find so incredibly sinister. In no other element of medicine do you have a doctor-patient relationship where the affirmation of the patient is at the forefront of any decision made by the clinician. I mean, that's just upside down world. I mean, imagine if that patient were an addict, as you mentioned before, you know, it was an addict sitting across from you. Do you then say to the fentanyl addict, well, actually, I'll prescribe you more fentanyl because I need to affirm your addiction? I mean, it's
That cannot
ridiculous.
Be far behind. Cannot be far behind.
I'll give it California time.
Yeah. Give it a week. Precisely. And in fact, until trans came along, first of all, this is, and I have such sympathy for older mental health professionals who were schooled and entered the field before the modern insanity, because they're all screaming about this and they're right. affirming the patient's identity without questioning it is not only not, was never a standard practice in mental health, it is actually anti-mental health. It is the precise opposite of the practicing ethos of mental health professionals. You don't affirm delusions. You don't, you are supposed to be exploring the psyche of a person who comes to you who needs help with their emotional processing, whatever it is. And the process of therapy is helping the patient discover the lies that the patient tells themselves, the things that are buried in their unconscious that are driving their actions in contradiction to what their conscious mind knows is good for them. It is to make yourself more transparent to yourself and to question the thought patterns and processes that brought you to the point where you felt you needed therapy. So it is anti-therapeutic to simply rubber stamp a self-diagnosis or a self-description. This has completely reversed. Nothing that's going on that's affirmation only and affirmation first is in any way therapeutic. That kind of behavior is the kind of behavior that prior to this, Marie, would form the basis of a patient complaint that would get you struck off. What we compel mental health professionals to do now is that very thing that could have gotten them delicensed 15 years ago.
Yeah. Well, and this is the other, there's so many different elements, right? So that would have gotten them delicensed 15 years ago. It's the reverse now. Yes. This country, if you don't affirm or you try to be more critical as a therapist of somebody who's in your care and that they're going through puberty and they're washed with hormones and trying to basically figure shit out, as pretty much every time, I've got two teenage sons in this house, believe me, there's lots of figuring out going on. The most important thing you need to give these kids is time.
Yes.
To be able to do that. Well, here, if you're not careful as a therapist, depending on the ideological bent of the parents, they could have you up.
Yes, and it happens. It's happening. We've seen it happen, and it will continue to happen.
There's also the element, too, I think, in the United States, not quite so much here because of our socialized medicine model, but we do have, and for the last 6 years prior to 6 months ago, a fully ideologically captured, highly progressive government. So they were on board with us, boots and all. But in the United States, Asim Mahotra, who's a cardiologist in the UK, often talks about this, is the capture of medical institutions, especially within the models that you have in the US, a little less so in Australia, where there is money to be made. So you have the corporatized structure of hospitals.
Yes.
Who apply pressure on clinicians or will favor clinicians that will favor treatments that will then in turn favor profits. Do you think there's an element to that?
Oh, it's obviously so. Anybody who goes into a medical conference in the United States and actually listens to what they're telling doctors and hospital associations, they're quite brazen about it. You know, we'll make hundreds of thousands. This procedure is very profitable. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm. Would you say?
I don't have the numbers right to hand, but there are a couple of organizations out there that have tracked this. And maybe between 10 and 20 years ago, I believe there were two so-called gender clinics in the United States. There are now more than 300, and most of them are advertising themselves to minors or to parents who have children.
Hmm. Yes, because because you mentioned those states before, the sanctuary states, California and Minnesota, I think Minneapolis was one of those clinics, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and that from decades on. And I guess that then goes into the whole space now of, and again, we're seeing this here, between the transsexual movement, the original T's, the OTs, as it were, and transgenderism. And there is, like, I know there's definitely the LGBs are having a bit of a divorce from the rainbow community. And I know that
we're trying.
Yeah. And a lot of these OTs are sort of saying, hey, don't lump us into this. You know, we came to this in our adult life. We've made a very distinct decision about what it is that we're doing. We're not part of this mutilation.
Right.
And also, too, like the other thing that has stunned me And no one, and it's the whole, again, social contagion element, how those within governmental organizations or medical organizations cannot look at a signal of, when you look at the original transsexuals, they were nearly always male to female.
Yes.
Very few of them were female to male. I mean, Buck Angel is probably one of the few exceptions, you know, well-known exceptions, but.
Yes.
Yeah. Now it's a complete reversal. It's predominantly young women to male.
Yep. A couple of things about that. Couple of things. We could record 16 hours and not get to the end of this. First of all, this is, I'm going to have to do a show segment on this because I think it needs to be talked about. And I see no one talking about this. You are correct that the old school transsexuals were almost always, quote, male to female. What people do not know, but I know because I was friends with these people. I've been out of the closet since 1987. I've known a lot of gay people. There has always been a contingent within lesbians who are just this side of what we call trans today, stone butches, who were binding their breasts flat, wearing packer material to give their crotch a bulge inside their pants, and adopting male names, and for all intents and purposes, living as men. Some of them did indeed have mastectomies. This is not new. It's not something that only started happening 10 years ago. But there weren't nearly as many, of course, as there are now. It wasn't the young girls. That's what's different. But part of, I think, the distortion that goes on in this conversation comes from many feminist activists who believe and want the rest of the world to believe that all of this is happening because of men and maleness, the essential rapist nature of men. Well, that's poppycock. What this movement has done has given social space and legal space, unfortunately, to rapist-inclined narcissistic men. They are indeed having a legal field day at women's expense now. That is true. Mm. They didn't start this, though. They didn't start this. And it is not true that women have been pure as the driven snow about this and were just victimized by the whole thing. That's not true either. But these, what you call transsexuals, back when I was young, just coming into the gay community, there was always one or two maximum in any social grouping, maximum. There was always one. Every once in a while, there were two. There was never more than that. Most of them were the extremely effeminate gay men with such severe mental problems that they honestly believed they could not live their life unless they tried to become a woman, right? I don't agree with that. I don't think that that is a healthy outcome. And I cannot be argued into the position that, well, some people need that. My answer to that is no, no one needs that. People all need help. Yes, they don't need mutilation. Be that as it may, these men, well, they were walking a fine line. But what I remember about that time was they wanted to live as women, but they weren't like today's trans activists. They weren't demanding and screaming and pushy. And they didn't actually expect everyone else to pretend that they'd been born a woman. They didn't.
They often lead very, very quiet lives too. Yeah, it's but again, that comes to the whole because a lot of the gay friends I have are in their 60s now. So many of them were at the forefront of homosexual law reform in this country. So they came out, had to come out very quietly because it was illegal, and then they've sort of moved through. And all that they've ever wanted is to live the same life as anybody else.
Yeah,
and be the same as anybody else. and not have to say, hey, you know, how we choose to lead our lives behind closed doors shouldn't make any difference to, you know, to marriage or any of these other things. So, and it's just, I find it quite incredible that when finally, in a lot of Western nations, when that moment finally got reached, a lot of this trans activism bubbled up is it because those activists that were moving in that space were saying, oh, well, we've kind of done ourselves out of a job now. What does a good activist do of a day when they've got nothing to be active about? I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I think so, but I don't think most of them consciously articulated that thought to themselves that explicitly. What I think it comes down to is that, and I'm speaking in generalizations, there are exceptions. People who tend to be professional activists, and I don't necessarily mean just people who are paid, but people who spend their entire lives being an activist about something, tend to be certain personality types are overrepresented among those people, and Cluster B is overrepresented among these people. The problem they claim to want to solve is not, in fact, what their goal. It's not. They say, well, we just want equal treatment for trans people, or we just want gay people, blah, 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 blah. Well, the reason it's so easy for them to just copy paste onto the next issue is because the goal for them is not the described problem. It is the process itself. It is being an activist. It is being seen to be an activist, and being able to exert control over other people by changing the culture, changing the laws, and socially excommunicating people who are not on board. These are narcissistic people who are not motivated by altruism. That is a large part of it, I think.
Yeah, and it only takes a very, very small number of those to upset a social fabric.
Yes.
I mean, we have seen that, haven't we?
Yes. And when you talk about, you know, this incredible rise in the number of young girls who are coming into this, I looked at some of the numbers in the CAST report 2 weeks ago for my show. And one study they were looking at showed I'm working from memory here, so I don't claim that this is 100% accurate. One clinic they looked at, I believe, or it may have been the entirety of the gender clinic system in the NHS. In 2009, a couple dozen girls were referred to gender identity clinics. And in 2016, it had gone over 2,000, I believe, if I remember correctly. With the boys, it was maybe four dozen in 2009, so double the number of girls. And then it had gone up to, I think, more than 500 in 2016. So the girls got a bigger jump, but the boys also had an extraordinary jump. But what's going on with the girls, it seems very, very clear to me, okay? This is just the court of Oye and Terminer in Salem, Massachusetts in 1692. It is exactly the same thing. What do we have going on in Salem courts in 1692? We have young girls, adolescent girls, emotionally overwrought adolescent girls who are being manipulated by narcissistic adults who have legal and land and reputational disputes to settle with other adults, who see that these emotionally fragile, manipulatable girls can be used to accomplish their ends. So they take advantage of the hysteria of the 14 or 15-year-old girl who begins to believe that she is being beset by specters and witches and all this other stuff, and throwing themselves around the room. I mean, literally, if you look at the descriptions of what happened in those courtrooms, those young girls were literally pitching epileptic-style fits on the floor, screaming, tearing at their clothes, and saying, that witch over there has set his familiar on me. Right? It is exactly the same behavior as you see on TikTok right now when you see these screaming adolescents and, frankly, young adults melting down on their college campuses or in airports or anything like that. You come up to more modern times. For whatever reasons, it is simply a fact that adolescent puberty is harder for girls than it is for boys. It's hard for all kids, but it is harder for girls. It's emotionally harder because of the hormonal profile that starts happening in girls. It's more difficult because girls have to contend with a period and their bodies change in ways that boys don't. They grow breasts, they grow hips, they become sexually attractive to men, sometimes to creepy older men. There's a lot of pressure and shame for adolescent girls that is different from what boys go through. They are naturally inclined to emotional hysteria. That's just a part of typical female adolescence. It's not a, there's nothing misogynist or sexist about that. It's biology. 1970s comes along and an anthropologist publishes a paper about a new eating disorder that he sees that involves overeating and then purging, sticking your fingers down your throat and throwing it up. He calls it bulimia nervosa. At the same time, singer Karen Carpenter's obvious anorexia became obvious to the entire world. You could not miss it to look at her.
Yeah.
And then all of the magazines started writing about anorexia and bulimia. And then it exploded. In the late 70s, Karen Carpenter died in 1983, but the anorexia and bulimia craze swept all the way into the 1990s. Today, trans is that. It is the same girls.
Yeah. And it is terrifying. You know, it is completely terrifying because of the, as you said, that affirmation model, because often back then you didn't necessarily have. So because if you imagine if they applied the affirmation model to the bulimic and anorexic girls of the 80s,
yep,
the carnage that would create, the absolute carnage. It's, you know, looking at, you know, a girl who's obviously in distress and saying, come on, you know, come on, fatty, mm-hmm. Let's go. You know, I mean, it's just, that's why it is just so utterly mind-blowing to see these models. And again, winding it all the way back to where we're at now is making sure that, you know, the grown-ups enter the conversation finally. Like, I know Andrew Doyle, he's been huge on the Case Report, and his book, The New Puritans, the whole opening tranche of his book was around those trials in Salem, Massachusetts. And he talks about...
Oh, interesting.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So he talks about the trials and the whole sort of culture, the Puritan culture that was in New England at that time, which also helped facilitate the hysteria in the girls because of the social structure. And you look at the new Puritans that we have today within the current progressive culture state. And that field is very, very fertile for this to happen again.
It is. And as someone who lives in the heart of New England, I can tell you that that Puritan culture is still here. It's different and it's modified, but you can see it and feel it. The enforcement of woke is almost complete throughout the New England region of the United States. You can drive through the various states. The New England region is five states, and it's a little bit smaller than the largest island in the UK. So they're about comparable in geographic size, and you can drive through several different states here, and you will see an incredible concentration of woke signaling to a religious pitch. Signs on lawns, banners over people's front doors, flags being flown, trans lives matter, black lives matter, in this house we believe, blah, 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 blah. I don't know if you guys had those signs down there, but we had a rash of obnoxious, smug signs that progressives would put up. In this house, we believe that science is real, human rights, women's rights are human rights. Abortion is health care. I'm sorry, I can't do it without mimicking that voice. But it's not just New England. It's throughout the United States now.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And well, it's everywhere. So I know that some people, particularly those, and I'm noticing now with dads, now that I've had this job and I'm the one that talks about a lot of the issues around gender, and I have a lot of dads come to me and they are pissed off.
Yep.
They're angry because this happened on their watch, and they're angry because they feel that they were lied to because the media lied to them, for starters. And mm-hmm. what woke a lot of these dads up was the Posy Parker rally here in Auckland.
Mm-hmm.
Because yep. it was so that was our CNN fiery but peaceful protest Kenosha moment.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So that
it was extraordinary.
It was extraordinary. And there were a lot of dads that saw, you know, the news presenter standing up front talking about how the counter protest was, you know, this wonderful, joyful thing. And you had even an MP saying how fabulous and wonderful it was. But the vision that got put up and the vision that circulated very, very wildly around social media at the time, and I've interviewed and gotten to know that citizen journalist very well, told a completely different story, of course. So the narrative, you know, the verbal narrative didn't fit the actual vision. And these dads saw this and they were like, whoa, hold on a minute here. This is going on in our schools. This is going on in our medical clinics. This is going on yeah. in our swimming pools, you know, yeah. and all of these sorts of things. So the dads have started to wake up, especially the Christian dads. The Christian dads are pretty angry.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, I think, now a groundswell of pushback because ultimately they have had it's been one-way traffic for years. And COVID bought them a 3-year pause for them to continue doing what they were doing while everybody was completely distracted by the pandemic. So yeah. you can imagine once the pandemic, as I said, the tide, it's like the tide of the pandemic has gone out and all of a sudden you're seeing all this wreckage and carnage and bodies and all these things left behind. Yeah. And they're thinking, well, how do they get there?
So. Yeah, I think there's another dynamic. This is, part of my job in life is to say unpopular things. There's another dynamic going on here, and that is, and it's in the West broadly, but of course I know the United States better than certainly I know any other country. But the role of the father in our culture has been systematically degraded over decades. And in some ways, yes, the role of mother too has been degraded. You know, women have been told that they're failing if they make their career out of raising their children and running the home, which is, of course, in my estimation, one of the most important careers in the entire world. And it is certainly a full-time job and more. There's no such thing as a mother who doesn't work. But at the same time, culturally, and feminism has a lot of responsibility to shoulder for this. What allegedly began as a project to secure the same legal rights for women, which most people agree with uncontroversially, long ago morphed into actual degradation of men for its own sake. To the point where it is now expected. You have to go back 30 to 40 years in American television or American television commercials to find an example of a father figure, either in a sitcom or in a commercial about dishwashing detergent or laundry soap or anything, to find a father figure who is not presented as bumbling and stupid and incapable of doing anything without his wife acting as his mommy. Another strain of that has been that everything about men, men's sexuality, men's interests is misogynist, that a man even looking at you crosswise in a bar that you don't like is committing some form of sexual assault or boundary violation on you. It has reached a hysterical pitch. And it has been feminism, not every strain, no. And I'm sorry, Marie, you're going to get angry emails after this is broadcast because of what I'm saying. And I apologize.
Angry emails, Josh, are just fine. So it's because this is okay. The thing we've got to be said.
Yeah. And I think it does. And, you know, one of the reasons why this trans nightmare has gotten as out of control as it has is because we have an imbalance of mother and father inputs, or masculine and feminine influences in our society. The feminine has been elevated to a position of cultural, it's almost been canonized. You know, be nurturing, be inclusive, take care of everybody. I mean, this is why we have cities and states across the country that are being overrun in the United States with illegal aliens who simply jump the border and will never suffer any consequences. Feminism has a lot to do with this. It's this ultra nurturing, feel bad for the underdog. It is the more empathetic and nurturing aspect that is more common to women, which is a derivation of the maternal instinct, can be hijacked and co-opted and misdirected toward people who do not need to be nurtured. They actually need to be locked up in cages, right? But this ethos has taken over everything, and men have responded by going quiet. And one of the things that I've said, and I'm going to say it a little bit provocatively, but people can put finer points on it if they want. One of the things our culture needs for a lot of these problems is men need to start telling women no again. And women need to be able to hear it. And I don't mean men need to have legal control over women. That is not what I am suggesting. But men need to reacquaint themselves with saying, stop it. No, we are not going to do that. We're not going to do that to our daughter. We're not going to do it to our son. No, we're not going to increase welfare benefits for illegal migrants, you know, da 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 da. That it is so out of balance right now. And I think that these men, these dads that are coming to you, all men need to think about what our responsibility is too. And I think we have a responsibility to be more vocal than we have been.
Yeah, agreed. And I think that that is why those who particularly live in the Christian space are the ones that are actually at the forefront of this, because they carry a lot of those values, particularly around family. And they're the ones that are speaking up. They are certainly here. We had a case here, one of the more modern churches here, a couple of the parishioners in two towns, one at Auckland, our main city, has a huge, big rainbow, the full intersectional flag as a, a crosswalk, a pedestrian crossing across quite a main inner city road. And so the grandson-in-law of the bishop of this church actually went with a team of people and painted over it and sort of defaced it. And that was after their congregation in a small East Coast city painted over the one there, which was outside the public library, as a protest to Drag Story Hour that was scheduled okay. there. Now, interestingly, is that they pleaded guilty, but they were given quite hefty fines, whereas the young man who bashed the 70, almost 80-year-old grandmother at the Posey Parker rally and broke her orbital bone and created quite a bit of damage, got a discharge without conviction and no fine, and that had only happened a matter of weeks earlier. And then you have New Zealanders look at this thinking, well, how can that even be sort of compared? It's insane. It is insane. Hey, look, I want to pick up a little thread that you just said about the societal grooming, particularly because it comes back to entertainment industry and media. And it was that parody of maleness that happened in terms of when you have of how they portrayed men in culture through sort of the 90s. And I mean, the first person that cropped into my head is that kind of John Goodman character in Roseanne and the Homer Simpson, I think, would have to be a very classic archetype of the genre, certainly. So you have that. What about now this? I'm seeing a parody of womanness through the likes of Dylan Mulvaney. Is that something you've observed?
Oh, yeah. Well, it certainly is. It is parody. I mean, what these men think women are, they're not becoming women. They're simply becoming narcissistic drag queens. They're just narcissists. Think about the looks they choose. They tend to choose looks that are best described as Disney Wicked Queen villainess, don't they?
Very Maleficent, yeah.
Disney Wicked Queen villainess is a cartoon archetype of the Cluster B narcissist. As a matter of fact, 1939's Snow White, the classic Disney film Snow White, you remember the Wicked Queen?
Mm-hmm.
Her face is Joan Crawford's face, famous American actress Joan Crawford, best known to people from the portrayal in Mommy Dearest based on her daughter's autobiography. She was a complete unstable narcissist and child abuser. There's a reason why Disney modeled their Wicked Queen on her face. There's a reason why Disney modeled in 1989's The Little Mermaid, the villain Ursula was modeled on the American drag queen Divine, who looked like Ursula. These are parodies. They're parodies of what women and men are. They are not reality. They are narcissistic, one-dimensional representations that are about personal attention seeking.
Yeah, well, Dylan certainly likes attention.
Yeah, he does. You know, I've got to... My sympathy is limited, to be frank. My sympathy is limited. When I hear women say, you're appropriating womanhood, you're parodying womanhood. Okay, what are you going to do? Cry about it all day and say, mommy, daddy, make that man stop making fun of me. Make fun of him back. Instead of crying and whining about it, I'm sorry. I told you my sympathies. I have almost no sympathy left for this.
Yep.
I don't care. And I don't think anybody should care. The real problem, the real actionable problems, first of all, the biggest victims of this are children, not women. Children, not women, not the transsexuals, children. Children are being mutilated. Children are being psychologically brainwashed and distorted to a degree that we would not see out of a CIA. We wouldn't see except in a CIA operation. Women are, in fact, more in danger now because in most of the parts of this country, you can't stop a man from going into the women's bathroom or the women's locker room or the women's swim team. You can't because it's discrimination. It's perverse and insane. These are real problems. Right. But the complaint about the appropriation and the parody is so surface and minor because it's about ego. It's not about actual harm. It's about ego harm. You can have your feelings about it. Like, for example, when I see women who transition to male, so to speak, I find it irritating when I see them using gay men's spaces. Gay men find them very irritating. Some of these women have successfully convinced, I mean, I don't approve of hookup sex apps, but they are popular and people use them. But some of these women have managed to get gay men's sex hookup apps to not only forcibly allow these trans men to be there, but to ban actual gay men who object to it. So yeah, that kind of thing irritates. But I don't go around saying, they're appropriating manhood. They're degrading what it is to be a man. But I hear this from feminists all the time. And I'm just like, so what?
Do you think that is a reason why so many gay men have been quite outspoken on this topic and have been much stronger on it? Like a lot of the gay women that you see talking about this tend to come from it from a feminism perspective, whereas a lot of the gay men coming from this are coming from it from a protect the kids perspective.
That may be part of it. It's probably also that, I mean, there are a lot of women and there are a lot of feminists out there who have been banging the drum about this. I don't mean to say that they are all exactly of the same stripe. And it is true that, I mean, you know, Kelly J. Keene, Posey Parker is one of them. I mean, she is one of the bravest and most directly spoken women. And she serves She occupies a place that is irreplaceable. We need that. And in fact, I think we need more of it. But men tend on average to be more direct and more willing to be pugilistic verbally and otherwise. Women tend to be less direct and aggressive. That may be part of it as well. I'm not sure.
So in the now, in the light of Cass, in the light of the WPATH files, and you've got an election coming up, what do you think, I mean, what would you like to see and what do you think will happen in the next little bit, particularly in the United States, because that's obviously the market and the place that you know so well around this issue?
So what I'd like to happen isn't going to happen. Because I see these problems. I see trans, I see the renewed war of the sexes, men and women hating and misunderstanding each other and accusing each other of things. Many other social problems and political problems we have right now. I see these all as symptoms of a deeper underlying sickness. I don't know what the name for that sickness is, but it has something to do with a lack of true meaning and purpose in our lives. It has to do with being fed media distortions so completely that we no longer know very much that's actually true about the world around us. I'd like to see a wholesale change in our culture to get away from the narcissistic, the self-aggrandizing, the victim posing for special privileges. I don't think that's going to happen in my lifetime. I could be wrong, but I think what is likely to happen on the trans issue specifically in the United States, I confess that I worry it's never going to stop. I'm not certain that it is going to stop. I think there's a good chance of it, but I am not certain. But it's going to take lawsuits. It's going to take so many lawsuits. We're not going to get a federal ban on doing this to children. We're not going to get that. We're going to go state by state and lawsuit by lawsuit. So my hope is that there will be enough of that this reaches a fever pitch and that transing children will become as taboo as performing lobotomies became after the lobotomy craze died down. But it's unsatisfying. Because if we don't address, and we're not going to, but if we don't address the underlying sickness that gave rise to this symptom, another craze is going to pop up in 5 years that will destroy people in another way.
Mm. Yeah. Matthias Desmet talks about that in his book, The Psychology of Totalitarianism. And one of the key ingredients, and there were four ingredients, and one of the key ingredients for creating a sort of a mass hypnosis, as it were, is a lack of meaning making. I think when you've got people like those with cluster B personality disorders, it only takes one or two of those to sow a seed that can grow a very noxious weed.
It doesn't take very many, but the problem we have is that I do believe we have a higher percentage number in the population than we've ever had before, so there are more of them.
Mm.
And they're disproportionately influential, and most people cannot easily detect them until they have an awakening or they come right to the coal face with it in a personal way. That had to happen for me. I know that one of the things I realized over the past 7 or 8 years, and people have a really hard time with this and they really react against it. I understand because I used to react against it too. In fact, I didn't even understand why it was supposed to be a problem. There are millions and millions of people, Marie, in the United States who think of themselves as people who are for democracy or for our constitutional republic form of government. They are in fact communists. They're communists. I was a communist. I did not know that I was one, but I was one. Because being a progressive leftist is communism. It is. And it's been such a slow boil over so many decades that we've slipped into it, right? And that's why people are so shocked when they hear it, right? Well, when did that happen? When did I become a communist? I can't possibly be a communist. But call it totalitarianism, call it communism, call it statism, call it authoritarianism. They're all describing the same thing. It's top-down control, top-down setting of the moral agenda and the parameters of public conversation, and it leads societies to ruin. Maybe that is the underlying problem.
Yeah. Well, that's another conversation for another day, I think. We could do this for hours. Hey, look, this has been Josh Slocum. I know, we could do it for hours. Disaffected podcast. And again, people can find that on Rumble. Are you anywhere else as well?
We're on Rumble. We're also on YouTube. Although our show is done on camera, it looks like a one-man talk show on TV. I'm a talking head. We also put it out as an audio only on all podcast platforms. You'll find us.
And it is definitely worth a listen. It's one of my guilty little pleasures, I have to admit. I do thoroughly enjoy it. And I do enjoy our chats, Josh. As always, it's been so good to catch up. It's been wonderful. This has been Josh Slocum here on Counterculture with Reality Check Radio.
Thank you.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.